So I know many of you. I think I would know even more if it weren't for circumstances and meeting through Zoom. But for those of you who I haven't met as fully, my name is Brett Cardale. I'm 35, and I joined the Sangha about a year ago. And this is the story of my way-seeking mind journey. I was born and raised in Turlock, California, which is a small town outside of Modesto, here in the Central Valley. It's home to a lot of agriculture, conservatism, and church-going Christians. However, my family did not go to church, and it was because my parents were golfers. So they spent Sundays on the golf course, and my sister and I were dropped off at my grandmother's house. But that was great. I loved it. My grandmother was wealthy, and she lived on a big ranch with cows and horses and chickens. She had a pool, a tennis court, and even live peacocks that walked around on the grounds. It was really a paradise for a kid, and I treasured my time there. But there was a problem. When I was 8 years old, at school, the next common question that I would be asked from other kids after, "What's your name?" is, "What church do you go to?" And when I answered that I didn't go to church, I was told very matter-of-factly that I was going to hell. And I remember laying in bed many nights, filled with fear of my impending destiny, burning in hell for eternity. I felt like an outsider as well. And eventually I became so afraid and motivated by my fear that I went to church by myself, or with my neighbor. There was no hope for my family, but I was not going to suffer their fate. I also started going to a youth group during the week, and I remember singing in a choir at the church briefly. I don't remember feeling particularly aware about what the message was at the church. I was just relieved that I had escaped my fate with hell. As I grew older, in high school, the study of biology, evolution, and science would put an end to my childish fear of hell and subsequent membership to any Christian church. I became an atheist and a rational materialist. Coincidentally, I had also started playing golf, which leads me to believe if there is a Satan and a hell, there's golf courses there because there's some sort of connection. Anyways, I played golf and I played on the high school golf team. But every day that I would have a match after school, I was filled with dread and fear and panic all day. It was debilitating, extremely hard to study in class and pay attention. I just dreaded it all day long. I dreaded the competition and playing poorly, humiliating myself. Eventually it became so bad that my mom got me in touch with a therapist she thought would help. And here I would meet the first very important teacher of my spiritual journey. She would play a key role in turning, tuning my way-seeking mind. But it started with a rebellion. The conclusion that my therapist helped me reach was that I didn't actually want to play golf. I had been urged and forced to play by my parents from when I was young, and I had resisted for a while, and then I started playing, but I really deep down, I didn't want to. And, you know, and my anxiety really centered around the fact that I didn't think I could tell my parents that I didn't want to play and quit. So after a few sessions, I mustered up the courage and I told my parents that I quit. And my mom was furious. I remember her saying, well, what did I pay for? But I had learned that it was okay to stand up for myself. The rest of high school, I was a very driven student. I knew that I did not fit in with Turlock, and I realized that going to college after high school was my quickest ticket out. So I studied really hard. I took all the hardest classes I could. I got all A's, and I graduated number two in my class of close to 1,000 kids. That got me into UC Santa Barbara to study film, which was a profession that I had wanted to enter from a very young age after seeing Jurassic Park. When I got to college, I thought, you know, everything should be perfect now. I had made it. All my hard work had paid off. I was out of Turlock. But I got there and it was big and scary. And I was anxious. I felt anonymous in big lecture hall classes, kind of invisible socially. I just there were so many people. How do you fit in? I remember I started smoking a lot of weed at that time, just to numb out. And I was basically depressed. One night when I was back in my hometown for a holiday break, I hung out with my friend Steve, who I had known most of my life. Our parents were good friends. We had been friends, but he was a year younger than I was. And, you know, we never liked best friends or anything like that, but that would all change. We were hanging out and he had gotten psychedelic mushrooms, and we decided to take them in his room after his parents had gone to sleep. And it was life-changing. What I remember the most about that experience was experiencing a sense of wonder, joy, ease, and concentration that I didn't remember experiencing since I was a young child. I realized during that experience that I had built up mental walls and habits to protect myself from feeling pain or from getting hurt. And they had become a prison. I had made myself a prisoner of my own protective mechanisms. I also noticed that how my mind completely colored and created my perception of the world around me. My understanding of the nature of reality had been altered, and reality was not what I had assumed. The problem, if there are any takers of psychedelics know, they wear off and you come down and you can't remember that vision that you had, that penetrating perception. So soon enough, I was back in my protective casing. And I decided it would be good to talk to a therapist or a counselor. So I got the number of the therapist who I had seen four years ago, my freshman year of high school. She agreed to work with me over the phone since I'd be in Santa Barbara and she was in Modesto. I told her all about the epiphanies that I had had on mushrooms and how it made me question the nature of reality. And this prompted her to reveal a new, completely new side and approach to working with me that I had not been privy to in high school. It was very straightforward in high school. You have a problem, and you know, let me help you solve it. But now she sensed that I was, I guess, open to talking about bigger ideas. And she, this was my first kind of introduction to some Eastern religious thoughts, very light, but just a gentle tap on the door. So I continued to kind of drudge through school. I enjoyed my film production classes, but that was about it. I continued to have some experiments with psychedelics again on pretty rare occasions that I could get them. I knew these experiences were very important, but I didn't know, I still didn't know how to integrate them in my, to, with my regular life or really how to talk about them. I felt like what I was experiencing, on psychedelics contrasted a bit with reports from other people I knew, other peers that I knew who were taking them, and they seemed to respond to them more as just kind of like strong, or like they were fun, like a very strong marijuana. Not really reporting this like kind of hugely important life altering experience. So midway through my second year of college, I just reached a point where I didn't want to go on with school. I had become just disillusioned with what I thought life was all about and what I was even striving for. Why was I doing all this? It just felt meaningless at the time. So I decided I was just going to stop school for a while. I was going to quit and focus my energy on making sense of the world. I had two jobs, and I was just going to work for a while and try to figure things out. So the moment that changed the course of my life was a chance encounter with a book while I was babysitting. One of the jobs that I had was working at the daycare of a Unitarian church. It was a great gig. I got to play with kids and have a good time. At that point, I think I was even considering maybe switching and going into like a education curriculum to be an elementary school teacher. It seemed, you know, that had just an immediately obvious purpose, or like that was doing something with my life that seemed meaningful. So the job was great, but it was also a hotbed for picking up babysitting gigs because of the credibility that working there got me. So parents were basically, you know, beating down my door to hire me to watch the kids while they, so they could get out. Anyways, so one night I was babysitting, and after the kids were to bed, I was sitting in a room that had a giant bookshelf in it, 100 books. And I was just looking through the books. And for some reason, this particular blue book caught my eye, and I took it out of the shelf. And that book was Be Here Now by Ram Dass. I had never seen a book like this before. I began to read the story of Richard Alpert's journey from Harvard professor to his experience with mushrooms and LSD at Harvard. And then finally, the miraculous circumstances of his encounter with his guru in India, Neem Karoli Baba. It's hard for me to put into words what happened to me upon reading that story and the rest of the book that night. But it answered questions for me about my own experiences with psychedelics. And it cleared away doubts that I had, kind of the wrestling between my rational thinking mind, or like the mind I had been growing up to that point, and then my experiences on psychedelics. In this book, Ram Dass describes the feeling of surrender that happened to him upon meeting his guru. And he just talked about it like, you know, it was just a feeling of I'm home, I'm finally home. And that mirrors the feeling that I was having. It was like, everything just clicked together for me. I felt a big weight lift off my heart. I trusted him and what he said and his story. And his story was, like this proof that my rational thinking mind needed to let go and to open to a bigger perception, a bigger possibility of reality. I was now a spiritual seeker. I continued to talk regularly with my therapist, and I gobbled up books on meditation, Eastern religion, and listening to every Ram Dass lecture I could find. Life was once again exciting. I looked at everything differently. I started meditation and was drawn to Zen Buddhism after picking up a copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Coincidentally, other exciting things started happening in my life. In high school, my friend Steve, who I had that first mushroom experience with, he was in a band, and I had filmed them a lot. And I really like learned the core aspects of my filmmaking craft by filming them and making music videos with them. But while I had gone away to school, they had continued working hard in their band, and they had caught the eye of I think the biggest band in their genre at this time. And that band was starting to produce other bands, and they had been invited to fly to Salt Lake City and record an album. And the band asked me if I wanted to come along and document the experience. Of course I did. So I was off to Salt Lake City to record the album. At that time, Steve and I got to spend a lot of time talking about our experiences with psychedelics and how I was, you know, bridging this connection and you know, into these practices of integrating these experiences of psychedelics into daily life. Steve got very interested in that too. And that was the start of our sangha. So the recording went really well, and then we went to LA, and the band played showcases for major record labels, and they got signed to Warner Brothers Records. And then we went off on tour for about 3 or 4 months all over the country, sleeping on a tour bus and on life on the road. This part of my life felt very Kerouacian. And indeed, I was reading a lot of beat literature at the time. Besides my filming gear that I needed, I had like a small bag of clothes. And then Steve and I decided that it was important that we had ample spiritual reading material. And I still remember all the other guys teasing us as we hoisted this full-size suitcase full of spiritual books into the tour bus. So the tour was fun, and after a few months we were back home. I bummed around living with the band and continuing my kind of nomadic lifestyle. At one point I had to go to the skin doctor to get a mole checked out, and I had brought my copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind with me, and of all people, the skin doctor was like, "Oh, well, have you been to Tassajara?" And he had gone, you know, and visited as a guest in the summer a few times. And he's like, "You gotta go to Tassajara." So I signed up, and I went to spend a week in Tassajara and do a workshop. I was enchanted with Tassajara. I immediately befriended many of the young practitioners who were there doing the summer work program. While my way-seeking mind was strong, my youthful energies were also present, and I found myself also accepting invitations from the work study practitioners to sneak out to some late night parties in the forest and smoking some weed there, and then struggling a bit to get myself to the Zendo in the morning. I swam naked in the creek, and I even developed a romance with one of the young women practitioners there, who in retrospect I feel was a breach of the precepts that I co-facilitated with her. But it did blossom into a beautiful spiritual friendship that has lasted many years after that. So I think it was ultimately a positive thing. But after my time there, I left wanting more of Zen practice, and I set my sights on a practice period at City Center as soon as I could. So I was back in my hometown, and and I knew that psychedelics weren't and aren't the ultimate answer. I was never going to, I had no confusion that psychedelics would enlighten me. But I still felt very, very drawn to explore them deeply in a sacred manner. Reflecting back on this in hindsight, I think I could describe it as, my faith was not deep enough. Lest you see miracles, you will not believe. And psychedelics let me continue to peek through the doorway and see the miracles. But my experiments got pretty far out. I was smart enough to avoid drugs I knew to be harmful or addictive. But short of heroin, methamphetamines, or cocaine, if a drug promised any sort of mind-altering experience, I would try it. And I tried LSD and MDMA and salvia divinorum and 2CB and 2CI. I would only take trips with Steve in controlled settings. One time, we just needed a place to have a trip, and the only place we could think of is just to rent a hotel room in Turlock, crummy hotel room. So we did that, set up a little altar, and away we would go. At this point I was taking very large doses, and I was really aiming for complete ego dissolution or bust. And during that trip, things veered into paranoia. Reality began to come apart at the seams. Literally anything I was touching, including myself, untwined like a fabric untwining. I became convinced that I had died, but hadn't realized it. Steve, who was still in the room, was just a projection of my mind. I flipped on the TV thinking, oh, this will ground me. Or maybe this will prove that I'm not dead. And I flipped on the TV, and a newscaster was starting a news anchor began his report saying, next at 11, a special report about finding the nature of your true self and discovering ultimate truth in the universe. I flipped off the TV. Finally, I laid down on the bed and decided that if I really had died, all that was left to do was die, like really disappear. So I laid down on the bed to die, but I couldn't. And there was a clinging to self that was strong, and it was a deeply held tension that I track back to. This is in the moment, like this early self-conscious tension that we're taught. And like to, and that's to hold our pee, hold our bladder. And I had issues peeing the bed as a kid. And I decided it was a fitting challenge that my final challenge to fully die would be to get over this early childhood complex. So I let go and I peed. All tension dissolved away and faded away. And for a brief time, there was peace and peace. And then I opened my eyes and I was back in a shabby hotel room in Turlock and a little wet. Other trips were much more blissful. I remember a particularly joyous trip in my parents' backyard. They were not home. With Steve again, of course, and some LSD. And I believe this was my first experience of what I is my experience of samadhi. I lost all sense of, I sat cross-legged. I was meditating on the grass and the tree. It was beautiful. I lost all sense of time and space and body and mind. I felt like just a vast radiance of space, no discernible direction or orientation. It was like an eternal orgasm. Things even got very, in subsequent trips, I got very like methodical and you know, experimentational about, almost scientific, I guess, if you will, of this exploration. Steve and I decided we would take turns, one of us being sober and the other taking LSD. And one person who was taking the LSD would lock themselves in a room with a zafu and a zabutan and some books, you know, whatever they wanted that were of a spiritual nature. And then the other one would be their support, but they would stay in the room, in a dark room. The other one of us would check on them every 4 to 6 hours and leave food for them outside the door. At one point, I was dropping off food for Steve, and he opened the door. And this is something, you know, we had planned. We weren't going to do that. I could tell immediately that he was in a very high state. He was smiling, biggest smile, and he said, you know, please come in for a minute. We sat cross-legged across from each other and just looked at each other. A million faces and emotions just passed between us, just coming and going, coming and going. Happy, sad, angry, scared, excited, laughing, tense, on and on. And Steve even started turning into other people. At one point, I remember him vividly looking like an elderly black man. The room around me and my peripheral vision was glowing brightly, even though the room was darkened. And I realized that while I was sober and hadn't taken LSD, I felt like I was in the middle of a trip like Steve was. And this was an important direct experience for me of how interconnected we are. We're constantly affecting and affected by the world around us to the point that if we pay close enough attention, distinctions of separateness are seen as mental constructs. I also gained direct experience that while psychedelics are undoubtedly a catalyst of states of consciousness outside of common everyday consciousness, it was the consciousness itself that altered. The drugs just made that easier. Steve and I would have some more psychedelic experiences after that, but what that experience really started for us was this ritual, which we called eye-to-eye meditation. And almost every time that we have the chance to meet, even to this day, it's only a matter of time that we get past the small talk and even the deep talk and simply end in silence, just looking, sharing this space. There are no thoughts in this space. There's just existence. So eventually I applied and was accepted to do a practice period at San Francisco City Center. So off I went to San Francisco. It took some time to learn the ins and outs of monastic life, but soon I got the hang of it and my meditation practice began to mature a little. I loved the monastic life, even though I struggled against it mentally. I had a hard time getting up because I had a hard time going to bed at night. I was a night person. I also kept waiting for some deep realization to hit me while I scrubbed floors that, as far as I could tell, were still sparkly clean from whoever had cleaned them that morning or the day before, dusting an altar with no dust on it. But no realization came. Cleaning a toilet was just cleaning a toilet. But I did wonder, maybe there was something wrong with me, that cleaning a toilet wasn't a transcendent experience. And at that point I was pretty convinced that all I wanted to do with my life was become a Buddhist monk. It seemed pointless to dedicate my life to anything other than the Dharma. I remember being pretty forthright about this intention during a private meeting with one of the practice leaders, who in turn related that he had made the same choice near my age. You know, I'm in my early 20s at this point. However, perhaps I was projecting my own doubts onto him, or perhaps he simply knew that any decision of this sort should naturally not be made hastily. But I left the meeting based on his reaction with a feeling that I wasn't pure enough for such a pursuit. And perhaps I was deluded for thinking that that was for me. While my practice period was meaningful and important, I didn't leave feeling at the time like I had made some great stride. So at this point, aside from my Zazen practice, I had read every book by Ram Dass multiple times and listened to dozens and dozens of lectures. This was before you could find all this stuff streaming online. So I was like buying, you know, tapes and bootlegs off of eBay of Ram Dass lectures on cassette. I bought an old Walkman again so that I could listen to these cassettes. I was always listening to him. I knew all the major periods of his life, the evolution and maturation of his understanding of the Dharma. And I knew that in 1997, he had had a stroke, which left him partially paralyzed. I don't know why it took me so long to also realize this, but I at one point realized that he was still alive and living on Maui. And best of all, he was holding retreats again that you could go and spend a week with him. This is in 2006. And there was one coming up in a few months. I signed up immediately. And soon enough, I found myself on a tropical paradise atop a mountain in Maui with about 30 other people and Ram Dass. I was the youngest person there, with most of the other attendees being baby boomers. I remember the excitement and anticipation the first day, waiting for Ram Dass to come out. I felt like a kid waiting for Santa Claus. Many people also reported that I looked like that. And again, you know, words fall short of my experience of this week with Ram Dass. You know, it was just a blissful week, and I don't remember having a single negative thought, worry, or care. And I felt like I was just in heaven for a week. Ram Dass often described what it was like to be in the presence of his guru. His guru loved everyone unconditionally, which he said was a striking thing to behold. However, he said that Ram Dass would say that even more striking was the fact that he noticed that he himself loved everybody in his presence. And I'm not implying that, you know, Ram Dass is a guru or my guru. Simply, my experience mirrored that. I mean, I just loved everybody while I was there. As the retreat was coming to a close, as if my vacation in heaven couldn't have gotten any better, I was approached by Ram Dass's longtime caretaker, Dasima. She explained that the assistant caretaker, who also lives with them, would be leaving soon. And she was wondering if I would like the job to come and live with her and Ramdas for a while. And I don't think she finished asking me before I told her yes. And just like that, I was living with the man who had been living in my head every day for the past few years. Life with Ramdas. Living with Ramdas was an amazing experience. Ramdas lived in a gigantic house, which was owned by one of his students and close friends who owned a lot of luxury property. Ramdas had been born wealthy, but at the advice of his guru, he gave away all of his inheritance and money throughout the course of his life. And now he lived by the grace of those that loved him in a gigantic house. The house was tucked away in the mountains in Maui, but it overlooked the ocean from a secluded height. It was like a Shangri-La. It had a giant pool, banana trees, and large open rooms. There were two hallways that extended down each side of the house, the middle of the house. Ramdas and Dasima had rooms on one hallway, and I had a whole hallway to myself in a room. In the morning, I remember waking up, having slept with the windows open to hear the waves crash and the breeze, and I remember little lizards crawling across my wall. In the morning, we'd meet in the living room with Ramdas, and he had a giant puja table that had pictures of saints from all walks of life, a giant statue of his guru on it, pictures of Hanuman and Jesus, and then a big picture of George W. Bush, who was the president at the time, because Ramdas had a practice of finding compassion even for the people he felt the hardest to have compassion towards. We'd eat breakfast together, and then I'd just spend my day doing chores and driving to town, climbing the banana trees to pick bananas, or just lounging by the pool with Ramdas. His stroke had left him with aphasia, which inhibited his ability to speak as eloquently as he had all those years and all those lectures. I mean, he could still talk, but he just didn't talk as much. But his presence was not diminished at all. And you just kind of understood that the words were superfluous anyways. You know, you just wanted to be around Ramdas and smile. We'd often take trips to the beach and swim in the ocean. That was his favorite activity to do because he was partially paralyzed in the ocean. He was, had no issues. And the ritual was we'd swim out to a certain point, and Ramdas would turn around and lay on his back and look up and just say, "Oh joy, oh joy, oh joy." And then we'd go back home. So one morning, Dasima had an errand to run. So it was just the Das and I. I made him, cooked him breakfast, and we were sitting at the table together, just him and I. And I just wanted to look at him. I wanted to just have him look at me, or I don't know, but I just started looking at him. And then suddenly he looked at me, and his eyes locked on me. We sat there staring at each other, just looking and looking and looking. And his eyes just had the strangest depth to them, a gentle, penetrating compassion. That I really haven't experienced looking at another person like that since Ramdas. I remember just feeling like I wanted to burst out crying, but I also felt this huge, huge stillness and emptiness. I have no idea how long we sat there. It was a while. And then we just smiled at each other and went back eating our eggs. Ramdas and I talked a lot about Naropa University, which is a school started by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche in the 70s. in Boulder, Colorado. Ram Dass had been one of the first teachers the very first year that the school opened. So I was asking him a lot of questions because I knew that I wanted to go back to school and get my degree, but I knew I wasn't going to go back to Santa Barbara or that kind of educational setting. And Naropa seemed like the place to be. I started reading a lot of Chogyam Trungpa's books. Ram Dass had a bunch of them. And I was captivated by Trungpa's fierce, penetrating approach to Buddhism. I decided that I was going to apply and that when I got back from Maui, that's what I would do. And that's what I did. Living in Colorado took some adjusting for me. It was cold and snowy. And the elevation was high. And you know, my lungs grown here at sea level in the valley. I don't think I ever really adjusted. I lived alone in a small apartment just down the street from the school. The school was a quaint little school that used to be an elementary school, about 100 years ago. It was small, intimate, and engaging. It was a stark contrast to the large auditorium lectures of Santa Barbara. Each class had 10 to 15 students in it. We sat in a circle on zafus. We started each class with sitting meditation. It was a dream school for seekers of the way. Classes I took ranged from compassionate activism to art, music, Tai Chi, Zen Buddhism, Chinese calligraphy. I dove wholeheartedly into my studies. And unlike other schooling that I had been to, these classes demanded that not only did you complete the assignments, but that you really courageously and vulnerably put your whole self into the experience. I did also find myself often distracted by attractive way-seeking women who were also roaming the campus. And it probably comes as no surprise that psychedelics were pretty easy to come by. So I enjoyed my time at Naropa immensely. But I do also remember often feeling oversaturated in my pursuit of the path there. I was surrounded by like-minded people, you know, seekers at all turns. My classes were in service of this path. I thrust myself deeper and deeper into spiritual practices. I attended Sesshin at a Rinzai Zen Center. I spent my nights watching Trungpa lectures that I checked out from the library. Every conversation, you know, revolved around transforming yourself. And, I was like burnt out. I wasn't practicing the middle way. My effort was too great. And I started to seek out normalcy. It's like playing video games, eating pizza on my bed. Like the character from The Matrix who cuts a deal with the machines to be put back into the Matrix and not remember a thing, I wanted to just be a regular old 20-something-year-old. I also questioned if by living this overtly spiritual life, I was engaging in what Trungpa had warned and coined spiritual materialism. Maybe it was time for me to put away my beads and holy books and just live life. Maybe that was the most courageous thing I could do. I was home on winter break. I started dating a girl from my hometown. She didn't know anything about Buddhism or Ram Dass. And I liked that. She moved to Colorado with me for my last year. And then after I finished, we moved to San Francisco together. Despite having become disillusioned with working in film, I knew I had a talent for it, and it was really my only skill. And I needed a job. A friend of mine from film school had started working at Apple in the film and advertising department, and he thought he could get me in on a project or two, which he did. And then a few projects turned into a few more and a few more until before I knew it, I was working there full time as a film editor. It was really bizarre twist, having gone from aspiring Buddhist monk living with Ram Dass, hippie school in Colorado, and now I was living the corporate life in one of the biggest companies in the world. And it was an extremely demanding position. On top of often 12-hour work days, I still had 2 to 3 hours of commuting between San Francisco and Silicon Valley. I worked a lot of weekends, I was started partying pretty hard when I had time off, drinking a lot. No psychedelics now, just drinking. And my demands at work got the best of my relationship with my girlfriend at the time, and we split. I remember I had bought a motorcycle at the time, and I just remember riding around, not drinking, but just riding around a lot, like thinking. So some months later, maybe 6 or 8 months later, still working at Apple, and think, you know, kind of normaled out. Then I met my wife, or who would become my wife. She was from Iceland, is from Iceland. She was on vacation in the States with a friend, and we met in a karaoke bar. The story of how we made that relationship work is a whole other talk in itself, so I'm just going to skip it. Just know that, long story short, she ended up moving to the States, we lived together. Eventually, we got pregnant with our first son and got married, and then we bought a house in San Francisco. Did that for a year or two, and then during that time, I did start my Zazen practice up again, which is nice. I felt settled in a environment again. I would occasionally attend the Shambhala Center in San Francisco, which was Trungpa's secular Buddhist organization that he started at the end of his life. You know, for the most part, from that period, I was married in 2013 up until last year, my practice was very mellow, or, you know, off and on, not very, very humdrum. I would still listen to an occasional Ram Dass lecture or a Trungpa lecture while I commuted, but, you know, I just hit a plateau. And as I was thinking back on this and writing this, it's like, on the one hand, that accurately describes my life during that time, that 5 years. But it's like, it's not accurate though, because it's like, that's very black and white. And it's like my understanding of reality and my moral compass and, the transformations of my mind that happened in my twenties. I mean, that didn't go away. That's irrevocable. My beliefs hadn't changed at all. I just wasn't actively practicing. I wasn't like pushing that edge. So in 2015, my wife, who's an ER doctor, started residency at UC Davis hospital here in Sacramento. I didn't see any work prospects for myself at that time, so we decided we would try having two houses. We kept our house in San Francisco and got a house here in Sacramento. Our son, who was 2 or 3-ish at the time, he would live in Sacramento, and we got an au pair. I would live in San Francisco Monday through Friday and drive back and forth. And I did this for 3 years, just driving. I was in a car. If I did that for 3 years, I was probably in a car, you know, a year of that time. I was just always driving. Again, to make a long story short, it took a huge toll on me. And at times it almost cost us our relationship. It was just really hard. But we made it through that time. And our plan was to move back to San Francisco after she finished. But we both had come to love Sacramento. And we decided we wanted to live here. So I started a lengthy search for a job, and I eventually found one. So I left Apple after 8 years. I was a bit sad to leave, but I had also been worn to a pulp by the demands of the job. I felt like I had done 20 years of work in eight years. I left having worked with some of the top creatives in the world and gotten to travel all over the world. And Tesla's in my driveway. My new job would pay me nothing, but I was going to get to be with my family again, and that's all I cared about. So in 2018, we were all living in Sacramento, and in 2019, we were pregnant with our second son. So in the weeks leading up to the arrival of my second son, I suddenly felt a really, really deep pull to resume my Zazen practice. It was so forceful that it was completely effortless to start. I began with a conviction that I had not previously known. I immediately started waking up at 5:30 every morning to sit. I sat at night before bed. I worked through mental barriers and hangups that had in the past knocked me off my cushion and knocked me off my practice. I was determined not to give up. And soon I felt it was time to seek out a teacher and a sangha. I was delighted to find a thriving group connected to Suzuki Roshi's lineage existed in Sacramento. I started attending the Thursday morning group pre-COVID, and then was able to attend a couple of these Monday night groups in person before we started meeting on Zoom. I connected with Jim one-on-one, and I felt a strong confidence in him as a guiding teacher. It's been just over a year now since I joined the group. My practice feels very stable and encompasses my whole life. The Sangha has been instrumental for my well-being especially during COVID. I've met so many wonderful people who have enriched my life and my practice immensely. And I'm very grateful. So thank you for listening to the story of my way-seeking mind. And thank you all for being a part of the Sangha.
Thank you so much, Brett.
You're welcome.
I think we all enjoyed hearing your story, and I think I tend to think that the kind of, as you said, Kerouacian journey that you've had, I tend to think, well, that was something, you know, only my generation got to do. And then somehow like the world closed in on us and those possibilities of wandering and seeking are so much harder for younger people. So your story is kind of encouraging, you know, that such a wanderings and explorations are still possible if one has the right to karma, I guess.
I certainly had a predominant feeling. I think that I expressed a little bit in the story of like, there was this period of, you know, 5 years where it was just like, I had kind of set out and I had stepped off a precipice, and it was like the next thing kept lining up, you know, like I had a direction, but I didn't know where it was going to lead. And it was just like one thing after the other. The next thing naturally like appeared before me, the next cue to go this way, or the next tip to go this way, or the next invitation to come this way. I don't know if I can't remember from Roland's, if anybody happened to have a question or anything, I'm happy to answer it, or if it's late, then,
I just have a comment, which was, I very much enjoyed your talk. Welcome to Sacramento. I was tired by the end of it, just because you seem to have compressed a lot of stuff in your 35 years. And I would also like to say that you have kind of a very sober, relaxed delivery, but it made me laugh many times. You have a very good sense of irony and humor, and I really appreciated that as well.
Thank you.
I was just amazed at how much life you squeezed into such short amount of time there. You said you're only 35, but thank you, Brett, for sharing that story. When you were talking about how we all are kind of connected, I was feeling good, and then 4 o'clock hit, and I was just totally humdrum. I said, there's no way that I could sit through anything, and I just kind of pulled myself together, and as soon as we started, I came in at 7, as soon as we started meditating, everything just came together, and I was just amazed at the power of Sangha and meditating together. It was just amazing how being together like this can just shift your whole mindset and just wake up. So thank you. Oh, I was going to ask you too, what was the name of the band, or the band that you toured with when you went across?
The band's name was Eveline.
Eveline.
Eveline, yeah.
I'll have to look them up.
I see Larry and Roland both have hands, blue hands up.
Go ahead, Roland. I'll follow you.
Roland, unmute.
Oh, Roland, you're muted.
There we go. Well, hey, Brett, thank you so much. What a wonderful talk. Our connection has been through the Thursday morning study group. You've been such an important part of that Zen studies group, and it was just fun and enjoyable to learn more about what fuels your wisdom and your creativity and the wonderful kindness that I sense in your connection with us. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Roland. Appreciate that.
Brett, it was just wonderful to listen to your story. And, you know, when you sit in silence, there's a connection, but it's not the same as getting to hear the story. So really appreciate it. And, just heightens the connection that we have as a Sangha to know a little more about your journey. And I just smiled when you were talking about being at City Center, and you were saying something to there was a line you had, not a line, but you talked about something like, I was looking for this great realization, but I found that cleaning toilets was just cleaning toilets. And I think there's more to that than you might have thought at the time.
Yes, you're picking that up, Larry.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I saw Jody's hand, and I also see Dora Lee's.
I also just wanted to thank you, Brett. I thought that your story was really compelling, and I've been curious about like what your story was, so now I have a better sense of it, and I'm glad of that. And I also wanted to say that I also have really appreciated your contributions you have, you're very open in a way that a lot of people are not, and often say things that I might be thinking or maybe haven't quite articulated yet. I have like a vague feeling, and then you just come right out and say it. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's what it is. So yeah, thanks a lot.
Likewise, Jody. Thank you.
Really?
Well, I think what's really moving to me about your story is, you know, there were so many sort of like incredible experiences that you experienced, and that was sort of planting all these seeds for your, you know, bodhicitta life. And but they were like ecstatic and joyful and at one, and going to Hawaii, and just this, you know, expansive range. And yet at the same time, it seems like underneath, way down deep in the dark, maybe not in your full awareness, there was something else that was deepening all along. And it seems like coming here to Sacramento and planting a different kind of ground here, it's like now that level is arising or something like that.
Yeah. Thank you, Dorley. That's accurately articulated. I feel something similar in that way. I mean, or I might describe it as like, you know, I mean, for all the experience that I did have, I mean, there was a, like, almost my enthusiasm and my push to, you know, soak everything up and like get out there is like, you know, in, this kind of goes back to the comment Larry had about, you know, like cleaning a toilet was just a toilet for me at Zen Center, but I didn't, that wasn't a lesson in wisdom for me at the time.
Yeah, was, right.
You know, mm-hmm. But to Larry's point, now I can look back and see the wisdom in that. I couldn't.
Yeah. Yes, it was still there underneath.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Tony. It looks like Tony and Dell. Tony, you want to go first?
Yeah. Hello. Oh, man, that was quite the journey. I enjoyed that very much. I moved away from Sacramento right before you got there, and I would have enjoyed the Thursday morning study groups with you there. We would have had a lot in common. You mentioned cutting through spiritual materialism. When I was incarcerated, my mom would send me in books, and one of the books she sent me was Chogyam's. And I had fallen away from my practice, and when I was in prison, that book led me back. Mm-hmm. So that holds like a very special place for me. And so when you mentioned that, I felt that connection of like his teachings led me back onto the cushion. And so I appreciated that.
Thank you. Thanks, honey. Yeah, it's very... His words, his writing, and his teachings had a gravitas to them.
Dale?
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I really wanted to, I appreciate what you had to say about your way-seeking mind, but I also enjoyed hearing about Ram Dass and also, of course, Trungpa Rinpoche. So that was kind of just an added enjoyment to the whole talk that you gave. Thank you very much, Brett.
You're welcome. And I was delighted to say anything about them in an environment where I didn't feel like I had to like somehow figure out a way to preface who these people are. I kind of just assumed that, you know, most of the folks here know these names or have even, you know, read their books. I hope my thinking was correct there.
Well, some of us have, for sure.
Many of us have, I think. Oh, Oscar has, maybe we'll let Oscar have the final question and then we close out.
Really a marvelous story. And I won't repeat, although I would love to, what everyone else has said about it. But I just want to say, it was really well told.
Mm.
And I think I don't know whether it came from Santa Barbara or years of film editing at Apple, but you have, there seemed to be a sense of narrative flow to your story that kept things moving right along. And there was a lot of subject matter, but you covered it all. And there was no sense of it being hurried or one thing stepping on another. It just flowed along. So I look forward to hearing more stories from you. You're a really good storyteller.
Thanks, Oscar.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.